Yeah, my microphone's not. I'm going to be a diva because it's not right. You're going to find me in my trailer.
Well, at least we are recording all that part.
So anyway, when Groucho Marx first met Charlie Chaplin, he invited Charlie Chaplin to one of his shows. And so Charlie Chaplin came to Groucho Marx's show and sat in the front row. And for the entire show, he just read the newspaper. And so, you know, it threw off Groucho Marx, so they were going to get him back. And they went to Charlie Chaplin's show, and Charlie Chaplin gave him front row seats. Well, this was after Coconut, so there were five of them. Zeppo was included. And so what they did was they traded seats, and they sat in the back, and they gave their five tickets to five Hasidic Jew rabbis who sat in the front with the full beard, epic beards and everything like that, and the hats. So Charlie Chaplin thought that, you know, the Marx Brothers were playing a trick on him, you know, going in disguise as these Hasidic Jews with these huge beards. And so Charlie Chaplin was ragging on him for the entire show until he drove the five rabbis away because he was so obnoxious to them. And, of course, then the Marx Brothers, like, totally were laughing about it and everything. And this became like a rivalry between the Marx Brothers and Charlie Chaplin for a couple years.
Oh, you want me to tell my Jean Harlow Claudette Colbert story?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, allegedly, they were at some function together, Jean Harlow and Claudette Colbert. And Jean Harlow kept referring to her as Claudette Colbert, pronouncing the T. And so Claudette goes up to Jean and she says, "Darling, the name is Colbert. The T is silent, just like in Harlow."
Ouch.
Okay, on that, let's do a countdown.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
This is Eric Jackson. I sell revenue stamps, and you're listening to Stamp Show Here Today.
Return to send up. Stamp collecting happens when we dream together.
Welcome to Stamp Show Here Today, episode number 85.
I'm Cash.
This is Tom.
I'm Scott.
And I'm your host, Dawn. This week, we'll be talking all about soda fountain favorites and the parcel post system. So let's get right to it. Hashtag Stamp Stories, ice cream. On June 30th, the post office issued a set of soda fountain favorites, a forever 47-cent sheet of 20. This issue celebrates soda fountain favorites, the cold, sweet treats beloved by people of all ages. The act of savoring cool, fizzy confections is a national pastime that dates back generations.
Brain freeze.
Each of the 20 self-adhesive soda fountain favorite stamps showcases one of these five illustrations: a double scoop ice cream cone, an egg cream, a banana split, a root beer float, and a hot fudge sundae. The stamp booklet includes four of each design. The words "Forever USA" are featured along the right edge of each stamp. The geometric silver tone patterns in the selvage and on the booklet cover evoke a classic chrome-accented soda fountain. The words "Soda Fountain Favorites" appears across the top of the booklet cover. To celebrate the celebration, here are some ice cream facts.
It's cold.
It's cold.
That it is.
And what's an egg cream? I have no clue what egg cream is.
Isn't that the stuff inside the Cadbury eggs you get at Easter?
No. Mm. Well, no, it's one of the pictures.
They just suck that out and...
Yeah, there you go. It's the middle of a Cadbury egg inside of it. No, it's the one with the glass, and it's got brown stuff on it with white stuff on top.
Brown stuff and white stuff.
That sounds nasty.
That sounds like a hot fudge sundae.
I think
it's in a glass. It's something you drink. But I've never heard of egg cream before.
I've heard of it. I've never had one.
You're in front of the computer. It's British.
It's British.
I would also assume it's very rich.
Uh-huh. And I don't think there's egg in it. Like, actual egg.
I wonder why they call it
British.
British? No, British eggs?
Something for Cash to look up next time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, we have a computer.
A beverage
here.
Consisting of milk, carbonated water, and chocolate syrup.
No egg.
The drink contains neither eggs nor cream.
No. Oh.
So it's the carbonated water that makes it different.
Ah, so that's why they call it egg cream, is because there's no eggs and no cream.
It's chocolate milk with it's carbonated chocolate milk.
No. Oh, okay.
Well, I mean, milk, carbonated water, and chocolate syrup.
That made sense.
Mind blown.
Unless the people on Wikipedia are wrong.
And I doubt they are.
And most people assume that it was actually originated in New York City.
Ah. And did they list anything else that isn't in this glass?
Just no eggs and no cream.
Yeah.
Around 500 BC, the people of the Persian Empire were the first to start making ice cream. And they would pour grape juice concentrate over snow and eat it during the hot summers. Which, actually, that's more like a snow cone.
Yeah, that's a slushy. Mm-hmm. That's not really ice cream. Okay, so forget that as an ice cream fact. That's a slushy fact.
But 100 years later, they invented the ice cream recipe for the royal families, which had rose water, vermicelli, saffron fruits, and other sweet flavors.
Oh, okay.
So, close enough.
High-end slushy.
Still not made with milk.
Yeah.
Or cream.
But it had ice.
200 years later, the ancient Chinese records tell of a frozen mixture of milk and rice that was consumed as a summer treat. There's your milk.
Now
there you go. There's ice cream.
That's ice cream. Mm-hmm.
So ice cream is Chinese.
So we can blame it on the Chinese.
Yeah.
All of your brain freeze.
So the slush...
Happily so.
So the slushy is Persian, and the ice cream is Chinese. Okay, I'll buy that.
Mm-hmm. For a dollar.
Flash forward a few hundred years, and the Arabs defined the modern recipe of ice cream by introducing milk and sugar as primary ingredients. Mm-hmm. Now, this is awesome. The most famous ice cream death.
Death by ice cream.
Mm-hmm. The chef of Charles I of England was beheaded shortly after his famous ice cream recipe started circulating in public. He died because he broke his oath to Charles I of England never to reveal it. Do not cross the king.
Especially not that one with ice cream. That is interesting that the recipe was so protected that they killed the guy for it.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Well, because it wasn't protected anymore.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of like closing the barn door after the cows got out.
Yeah, somebody has to be punished.
Mm-hmm. And in around 1744... that's when the Scottish colonists brought ice cream to North America.
Yay, Scotland.
Yay, Scotland.
I was going to say, that still doesn't forgive the bagpipes.
Nothing forgives the bagpipes.
Bagpipes are
when
epic.
They're in the Scottish Highlands in Downton Abbey, and the guy with the bagpipes, and everybody's just kind of sitting there at the table going, like, oh, God.
in Downton Abbey, they'd they'd wake the people up.
Oh, yeah.
With bagpipes, and it's like, how terrible is this?
Yeah, but at dinner, you know, they're sitting there at dinner, and here comes the piper, he comes around, and, you know, some of them are like going, oh. I love that scene. That's hysterical. Okay, so in 1813, when James Madison was inaugurated, at his inaugural ball, they served ice cream. Dolly Madison, her favorite flavor of ice cream...
Let me guess. Root beer?
No.
Chocolate?
No.
Okay, what is it?
Oyster.
Ew.
I know, huh?
Wrong on a whole lot of levels I don't want to get into.
I know, huh?
Do you like broccoli? Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Do you like ice cream? Yes, I do.
Yes, I do. Do you like broccoli ice cream? No, I don't.
In 1846, Nancy Johnson of New Jersey invented the first hand-cranked and portable freezer.
I remember doing that as a kid. My parents would make ice cream. They had a little ice cream maker. And, hey, somebody had to crank it.
The little red paddle, the little wooden paddles that go around in a circle.
Yep.
Yep, I had one of those too.
Sitting in a bucket of salty ice water.
They had an electric one, but they refused to use it because, well, child labor.
It's handmade.
Hey, if you're going to give the kid a treat and hype him up on sugar, you might as well make him work for it.
Make him work for it, exactly. In 1851, that was the beginning of the commercial ice cream production in North America.
Mm, my time period.
Yes, it is. In 1904, the St. Louis World's Fair, there was such a demand for ice cream that that's how the first ice cream cone was made.
Yeah, this one I know a little bit about, because if you look at the century of, or the celebrating the century sheet, and you pull out the St. Louis World's Fair, it shows a little kid eating ice cream. And what happened was there was a vendor there, and he ran out of cups. And right next to him was a waffle guy, a guy making waffles. And the guy making waffles was like dying. He wasn't selling anything. And the guy who was selling ice cream ran out of cups. So he said, hey, you know, I'm doing absolutely nothing going broke. You want to put the ice cream in some waffle cups? And that way I can sell something. And the guy said, sure, let's go ahead and give it a try. And it instantly exploded. And all of a sudden, both of them were making gob tons of money. And it really started the ice cream cone. And it was really, you know, this is sort of like Reese's chocolate in you got chocolate in my peanut butter sort of thing. And they can pinpoint the moment when the ice cream cone was invented. And I always thought that was really cool.
You should see there's a video that popped up somewhere I saw that there was some Turkish guy and a little, I think Japanese or Chinese kid, like probably like 6 years old, and he had this really, really long-handled scoop. It was like a outside like ice cream cart, and he was doing stuff with putting the ice cream in, and he kept handing it to the kid, and it's like he'd hand it to the kid would grab it, and he'd pick it up, and the kid was holding an empty cone.
Yeah.
And then he like went, no, and went to go, you know, put the ice cream then in the little paper thing and handed it to the kid. And the kid grabbed it and he pulled it back out and the kid's holding the paper cone. And he just over and over, it was so funny to watch.
Go on YouTube, anybody who's interested, because it really is incredibly funny. And it's incredible. The guy is so skillful in the way he does it.
Oh, it is incredibly talented how this guy keeps handing this kid. Yeah. The ice cream, and it's empty over and over and over again. At the end, obviously, the kid gets it, and everybody's just dying laughing. It's awesome.
I think it's a sleight of hand ice cream or something like that. Ice cream juggling or something like that.
I don't know, but it was funny.
But it is definitely worth the search. Type in a couple of words and see if you can get it, because it is incredible what this guy is doing.
In 1926, the first continuous and commercially viable freezer is perfected, marking the beginning of the worldwide ice cream industry.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1939, mass production of American ice cream was sent to boost morale of the Allied troops in Europe. Hold on.
Well, I went to YouTube and I just started typing in Turkish ice cream, and it's came up like Turkish ice cream man tricks.
Oh.
And there's a bunch of them.
Good.
In the second part of the 20th century, cheap refrigeration, explosion of mass production of ice cream brands, and introduction of soft ice cream made ice cream one of the most popular summer treats.
All the way to today. Cool. So now
it's frozen.
I'm going to go home and get that Snickers ice cream that's in the freezer.
But it's funny that we're talking about this, because like last weekend, both of my girls were sick, and we were planning to do a whole bunch of stuff, and it all got canceled. And I'm like, Friday on my way home from work, I stopped and I got like chocolate ice cream and mint chocolate chip, and I got whipped cream and cherries and fudge and caramel and everything. And I came home and surprised them with dessert after dinner was ice cream sundaes.
Oh, cool.
They were in heaven.
Oh, that's one of the facts that you didn't bring up, which I thought was kind of interesting, is why do they call it an ice cream sundae?
Because everybody hates Mondays.
That's right.
No, in the South, the soda fountains used to put fizzy water and ice cream together to make ice cream sodas. And quite a few cities said, you know, that's medicinal and stuff like that. And, you know, it's Sunday and you have to respect Sunday and things like that. So the ice cream places said, or the malt places said, we won't put fizz water in it. We'll just serve the ice cream alone. And so they called them Sunday ice cream. And after a while, it just got shortened to Sunday. And then everybody in the country and the world started calling it Sunday. They just dropped the Y and added an E. But it was to observe the blue laws in the South. And so I always thought that was interesting. Any other little tidbits?
I just want to know who got the idea to mix all these ingredients together and then churn it forever until it would become ice cream. It's kind of, to me, it's kind of like, who discovered frickin' butter?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Who sat with a bucket of cream and a stick plunging up and down until it turned soft? I mean, seriously. Someone was bored out of their mind to invent butter.
Well, my favorite story is...
Well, look at YouTube. Look at some of the stuff that goes on there. Somebody has a lot of time on their hands.
Well, mine was, you see a real... What were they doing? They saw a really slow-moving horse. And they said, that horse is moving really slow. Let's make glue out of it. Where did that come from? But the other thing is, somebody's mixing this, and they're mixing the sugar, and they're mixing the milk and everything like that. And they say, you know what this really needs? Oysters.
Get out.
I mean, I cannot picture oyster ice cream.
You haven't been to New England.
Mm-hmm.
I have been, but I figured there would be
lobster ice cream.
Well, yeah, you can get that too, I'm sure.
And now for Kaz's corrections.
That's what you get for by that look on your face of where that was coming from. That's what you get for recording a podcast during when I'm normally having lunch. That was my stomach.
Let's all gang up on Kaz. He needs to be corrected.
Okay. First of all, everybody who's listening, next week is the Portland Stamp Show. We are going to be in Portland. We are going to be recording there and stuff like that, but we will not be able to put up a podcast next week. So just a warning to everybody. Well, what we'll probably do is we'll put up like a replay of one of the old ones or something like that. The second one, I want to thank Tony M. for his very nice book. He sent me The Best of Applebaum's Corner. So I get to read through this and find some old stuff that we can readdress and maybe update. So this is very, very good, a very nice gift. Thank you very much. And lastly, since we're talking about ice cream and one of the stamps has a banana split on it, we make fun all the time of fruit on stamps, the grape stamps and the apple stamps and the pear stamps and stuff. I want to talk a little bit about bananas because it's interesting to me because I always get like these little banana candies and they are banana flavored and they don't taste like bananas today. Well, they did back in the 1970s because the banana that we used to eat in the 1970s went to kind of extinct.
Kind of extinct?
1960s. Oh, I was just corrected in the 1960s. It went kind of extinct. There's still some around.
A correction inside of Kaz's correction.
Yeah, exactly. So,
shocked.
Ooh, and it was called the Gros Michel, which means Big Mike. So the Big Mike banana.
All you need to do is add hammocks into that last sentence and you're done.
Yeah, I know. Okay, everybody laugh at Big Mike banana for a moment. and we'll all get it out of our system all at one time.
No. Don won't.
So the gross Michelle banana, bananas don't have seeds, the ones that we commercially eat. Now there are over 300 varieties of bananas and they all have seeds, and they're like watermelon seeds. You know, there's a lot of seeds, but the bananas that we eat commercially do not have seeds in them, so they are propagated genetically. So they're all clones of each other. So they're all the exact same plant. Well, a fungus attacked them and wiped them out because, you know, you take down one plant and you take down them all because there's no genetic diversity. So then they came up with a second banana called the Cavendish banana, and that's what we eat today, the Cavendish banana. And the Cavendish banana does not taste like banana flavoring or banana ice cream or anything because, again, that's the Gros Michel banana. And the Cavendish, they are saying that it is threatened by the same disease, but they're fighting it and they have various insecticides and stuff. So that's the story about bananas, and that's crossing that fruit. Was there ever a banana on stamps?
Well, of course. Are you kidding me? Talk to Steve about that.
Oh, yeah. Shout out to Steve Patillo. I know you collect bananas on stamps. But no, in the United States, did they ever have just a banana on stamps?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. So this is the only banana on stamp that I can think of.
Steve, correct him.
Yeah, Steve, correct me if I'm wrong. And take a look at the stamp. And if it's issued before 1960, then it's a Big Mike. And if it's after 1960, it's the Cavendish banana. And that's it for me.
It was just after dark when the truck started down the hill that leads into Scranton, Pennsylvania, carrying 30,000 pounds. Bananas, carrying 30,000 pounds, hit a big jump of bananas. He was a young driver, just out on his second job, and he was carrying the next day's pasty fruits for everyone in that cold, scarred city, where children played without despair in backyard slack piles, and folks managed to eat each day about 30,000 pounds of banana. Yes, just about 30,000 pounds. Dreaming again, John,
of bananas.
He passed the sign that he should have seen, saying shift the low gear, a $50 fine, my friend. He was thinking perhaps about the warm breath woman who was waiting at the journey's end. He started down the 2 mile drop, the curving road that wound from the top of the hill. He was pushing on through the shortening miles that ran down to the depot, just a few more miles to go. Then he'd go home and have her ease his long cramped day away, and the smell of 30,000 pounds of banana. Yes, the smell of 30,000 pounds of banana. He was picking up speed as the city spread its twinkling lights below him, but it paid no heed as the shivering thought of the night's delights went through him. His foot nursed the brakes to slow him down, but the pedal floored easy without a sound. He said, "Christ!" It was funny how he had named the only man who could save him now. He was trapped inside a dead end.
In our expert topic, parcel post issues. The United States, as a signatory, started foreign parcel services in 1887, but did not institute domestic service until 1913. The USPS, successor to the U.S. Post Office, officially ended international parcel post service in May 2007, after some 120 years of existence. International Parcel Post Service was replaced by First Class Mail International Service for parcels up to 4 pounds. USPS Domestic Parcel Post was an affordable method of sending large parcels of up to 70 pounds and a maximum combined length and girth of 130 inches via ground transportation across the U.S. Effective January 27, 2013, the USPS renamed its parcel post service from Parcel Post to Standard Post. Effective January 17, 2016, the USPS renamed the service again from Standard Post to USPS Retail Ground, a name intended to resemble those of competing services UPS Ground and FedEx Ground. So Scott, given the long period of the parcel post from 1887 to today, stamps were only used for 2 years. What's the story on that?
And now the outro.
Unless you're going to stay for the story.
I can stay for the story.
Really? Okay.
Yes. I mean, I left the office 45 minutes ago. I've got an hour, maybe even longer, because my boss says, get this. I guess there's this new thing called freezing, the cryogenics.
Yeah.
Where you sit in below zero, whatever, for however. Yeah. Yeah, the owner of the company and his daughter went to go do that.
Sure, why not?
And I guess you can get facials with nitrogen and all.
And you can sit in there and eat ice cream.
Yeah.
And drink egg cream.
So if they can sit in that, I think I've got a few minutes.
Okay.
Go for it.
To sit through this. Maybe I'll learn something.
Okay. Nothing useful anyway. It is stamps, after all. Well, what prompted the stamps in 1913 is they were looking for a way for accountability. They wanted to know how much money that they were spending or how much parcel post was bringing into the revenue stream. And so they devised this system where they would use only specific stamps on parcels. They renamed their fourth class mail system the parcel post system. And for that, they issued the series of 12 stamps, all in different denominations, but they were all the same size and all the same color. Now, one of the big ruckuses about that was that the postal clerks had to carry this extra stock in their drawers of stamps. It was accountable paper, so they had to account for all of that. And for them, they complained that it was difficult to count because they all looked the same. They were the same color, same size. And when they came in the sheets were not panes of 50 like the regular commemoratives. They were panes of 40. So it was also a math thing.
Mm. Yeah, when I read that, I thought, who the heck did that? A sheet of 40?
Well, it was because the size was different from the standard commemorative. So And obviously that was done so that they would be able to tell them apart from the standard commemoratives. But in a way, it kind of shot them in the foot. Now, you said that the stamps were only used for 2 years, which is fine, but they were actually only used for the parcel post systems exclusively for 6 months. Because at that time, they decided that it wasn't worth the effort. And they weren't going to reprint any more stamps, although a second set was designed, and they had dies made up for some of the values. Not all of the values had new designs, but they were made up, and they were kind of like the parcel post, or excuse me, they were kind of like the postage due stamps, a numeral and
they
scroll work and stuff.
They looked a lot like the 1915 documentary issue,
right.
Yeah, little ovals with numbers in them, and that's it.
Right. And they didn't make all of the values, but some of them had dies made, but they never got issued because they decided that it wasn't worth the accounting nightmare. And so what they did after 6 months is then they allowed parcel post stamps to be used on regular mail and regular postage stamps to be used on parcel mail. So actually, the stamps were only exclusive for 6 months. And they just used them up until they... And it lasted about 2 years before a majority of the stamps were used up. So that's where that kind of came from. But like I said, it was fourth class mail, and they just redesignated it parcel post. They came up with new rate structures and all of that sort of thing.
Yeah, they had so many 1 cent and 2 cent stamps left at the end that you will find, especially on, I see them a lot on postcards.
Yeah, you see the 1 cent on postcards a lot.
And those were not carried,
occasionally.
They were not carried fourth class. They were not carried by the parcel post. They were just blowing out 1 cent stamps that they had left over.
Right. The challenge is to find that you occasionally see the 1 cent on postcards. Very infrequently do you see the 2 cent. Sometimes you see it on regular letter mail as a solo usage. You know, finding any of the other values on letters is nearly impossible, if they even exist in some cases.
Although I do have a new goal in my life that I'm looking for, is the Orangeburg 3 cent coil was put out by, what, Bass and Company?
No.
No, well, no, the stamp was produced for Bass and Company, right? Is it Bass?
I thought it was Bell.
Bell and Company? Okay, it could be Bell and... I know it's a B word. Okay, Bell and Company. And I think you're correct there. I know you're correct. I bow to your expertise. But the Bell and Company used the fourth or the four center to send samples. And so I know that the Bell & Company used the 3 cent Orangeburg, which everybody should be looking for because it's a $10,000 stamp. And they also used the 2 center, but now I found out they used the 4 cent parcel post. So now I want to find a 4 cent parcel post used from Bell & Company because it's just, you know, the story behind the stamps. That's what turned me on. I sit up at night dreaming about stamps, and that's the new one I'm dreaming about.
That's true.
And bananas. Absolutely
and bananas.
So along with the parcel post stamps,
and,
we have...
Me and Big Mike.
So
okay, now I'm disturbed. That's disturbing.
So along with the parcel post stamps, of which there are 12, we also have 5 parcel post postage due, which are the same size as the parcel post stamps, but these are in green, and they feature numbers. And so when you talk about the parcel post stamps, they really kind of go together. There's not just 12 stamps. There's actually 17 stamps.
Was the postage due how much you owed after it got there?
Well, that would be deficient. I mean, if you were underpaid your parcel, they would deliver it, and they would use the parcel post postage due stamps on the parcels to indicate that you had paid the due amount, just as they would on a regular letter use postage due stamps. And they would put the stamps on there, and then when you paid it, they would actually cancel the stamps.
It seems to me after reading this that this was really a test in futility to determine exactly how much money the parcel post system had in coming in or going out.
Yes, it was a test.
And they created such hurdles to jump over that it couldn't possibly work. And they had to have seen this, saying, we are going to create so much problems just to get such a small amount of information that we could probably get some other way. I mean, why issue postage due stamps? Why not just use the normal postage dues?
Government? Because
it wouldn't have been accounted as a parcel post.
Right.
So now everybody has to...
They needed parcel post. How else were you going to ship your kids in banks?
Oh, yeah.
Can't use a train all the time.
Well, what if you wanted to ship a train?
On YouTube, we have video about mailing your child, which is parcel post. And we also have the 10 stamp facts, I believe, going up. And one of those stamp facts is the largest thing ever mailed through parcel post was a bank.
Mm-hmm. Brick by brick.
So go on our YouTube channel, everybody. It's Stamp Show Here Today on YouTube.
One last thing on parcel post. We've talked about books in the past. So for the parcel post system, there is a specific book about the U.S. parcel post. And it's called U.S. Parcel Post, A Postal History by Henry L. Gobi. Or Henry M. Gobi, excuse me. I can't tell my letters apart.
Yeah, the book is great because it goes into the parcel post. But the interesting thing, too, is that fourth-class mail and third-class mail at this time are really changing in definition. And that's sort of what brings about parcel post, is that they're changing fourth-class mail into a different service called parcel post. And that's where you mail your chickens and everything. But the
No, that's special handling.
Or actually, that's special handling, yeah. But it was handled by the Parcel Post Special Handling Division.
Yes.
The interesting thing that I saw out of the book are the uses, because the parcel post system was mostly used, it appears, to send small merchandise and samples, like little, you know, piece, the one that they talk about all the time in there is pieces of fabric, sending people pieces of fabric. So this would be a normal letter under normal circumstances, but for some reason people sent them parcel posts because they were sending so many of them at one time.
Well, not only that, they were cheaper.
Yeah, it was a penny instead of two pennies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a significant savings if you're a business.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And they also had where they were sending medicines. And if you sent a medicine through the mail, you had to pay a tax on it, even though you were giving it away. And you got to ship it by parcel post. So it sort of offset each other. And a lot of the medicine companies from this period started using the parcel post to ship their free samples.
All right, so that's pretty much the parcel post system in a nutshell. Did you learn anything, Don?
Yeah, I did.
Good.
You can ship Big Mike through the parcel post system? Now try to get through the outro without laughing.
Oh, challenge accepted. Challenge accepted. What's in it for me if I do?
I'll give you a Big Mike.
Never mind. Never mind. This is a family show.
Was.
With Big Mike.
With Big Mike. There's one for the blooper reel. Awesome.
Or Little Cash.
I was waiting for somebody to say something like that.
I have no knowledge either way.
And you don't want to.
You threw it out there. Someone had to jump on that grenade.
Yeah. It's like a pinata. You got to hit it. Wait a minute. I shouldn't have said that.
Come on. I want to turn the air conditioning back on.
I know. I haven't eaten. I'm delirious. I need to get through this. Thank you for joining us for episode 85. This has been Cash, Scott, Tom, and I am your host, Dawn. You can reach us with your questions or comments at stampshowheretoday@gmail.com, Twitter at stampshowht, or leave a message on our Google Voice number, 1-949-873-4298. You can also check out our website at stampshowheretoday.com or follow us on Facebook or watch us on YouTube. And as always, keep collecting.
And mention Stamp Show Here Today next time you go to the restroom, and you'll get a good seat.
You did not just do that.
About 30,000 pounds of banana. Yes, just about 30,000.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, the book that teaches you about repurfs, regums, color varieties, and much more. Get yours for $10 at www.philatelicsecrets.com today.
Hi, this is Bob Prager with Gary Poser Incorporated, and we're in Long Island, New York, in New Jersey, and our philosophy of Gary Poser Incorporated is this. We would rather pay very fair prices on 9 out of 10 collections that we look at versus trying to just offer very low prices on 1 out of 2 and making a big score. That's never our philosophy. So if you want to be treated fairly, please give us a call anytime at 800-323-4279. And again, my name is Bob Prager.
The smell of 30,000 pounds.